Cassette 2, Side 1. Is there a more widespread notion than the one that rural people are laconic? And is there a rural place anywhere in the world whose people really are? I was worn out, my clothes completely drenched, my thoughts were wandering. I thought of the chairs we sat on, discarded, I imagined, during the refurbishing of an office in Minneapolis or Miami, and about their long journey here. I imagined I knew why the women were doing this, ignoring the national sport on a Saturday, to gather around Farmer and chat with such mild desultoriness, voices low and musical and unhurried. Some years ago, he had added to his growing medical program a health project just for women and, lacking a gynecologist on the staff, had made his own quick study of the specialty and for a time practiced it here. He'd probably given a number of these women the first pelvic exams they'd ever received, and had talked to them about birth control, offering it if they wanted. The shouts and cries from the cockpit seemed to be reaching a crescendo, but they sounded far away. I felt as if I could fall asleep, and as if I already had, enfolded in femininity. The rest of the way back was mostly a descent, but there were still some slopes to climb. I straggled up out of another ravine, and as usual found Farmer waiting for me. He stood at the edge of a cliff, gazing out. I walked over to him. The view from where he stood was immense. Scrims of rain and clouds and swaths of sunlight swept across the yellow mountains in front of us, and the yellow mountains beyond those mountains, and over the Lac de Peligue. The scene, I realized, would have looked picturesque to me before today. So maybe I'd learned something. Not enough to suit Farmer, I suspected. Education wasn't what he wanted to perform on the world, me included. He was after transformation. I offered him a slightly moist candy, a lifesaver from my pocket. He took it, said, "Pineapple," which, as you know, is my favorite, and then went back to gazing. He was staring out at the impounded waters of the Artibonite. They stretched off to the east and west and out of sight among the mountains. From here, the amount of land the dam had drowned seemed vast. Still gazing, Farmer said, "To understand Russia, to understand Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Boston, identity politics, Sri Lanka, and lifesavers, you have to be on top of this hill." The list was clearly jocular, so was his tone of voice, but I had the feeling he had said something important. I thought I got it, generally. This view of drowned farmland, the result of a dam that had made his patients some of the poorest of the poor, was a lens on the world. His lens. Look through it, and you'd begin to see all the world's impoverished in their billions, and the many linked causes of their misery. In any case, he seemed to think I knew exactly what he meant, and I realized, with some irritation, that I didn't dare say anything just then, for fear of disappointing him. Part 2. The Tin Roofs of Cange. Chapter 5. It was impossible to spend any time with Farmer and not wonder how he happened to choose this life. I did some looking in the usual place. His parents came from western Massachusetts. He was born in the aging mill town of North Adams in 1959, the second of six children, three boys, three girls. His mother, Ginny, was a farmer's daughter. She quit college early to marry. You could see her in him quite clearly. She was fairly tall and slender. Her nose was his exactly, and her tendency to blush. Farmer's father, Paul Sr., was a big man, about 6'2", weighing in at between 230 and 250 pounds. He was a fine and ferociously competitive athlete, known as Elbows to people who played basketball with him. In later years, his younger daughters would rechristen him the Warden on account of his strictness. No makeup, no boyfriends, no staying out late. He was a restless sort of man. He had a steady job as a salesman in Massachusetts, but then a friend of his told him there was real money to be made in sales down south in Alabama. Alabama is a sleeping giant. In 1966, the Warden moved his growing family south to Birmingham. In retrospect, the years in Alabama were happy ones for Ginny. They were a little short on furniture, but lived in a real house, and they bought an automatic washing machine, the first one she'd ever had. The Warden also arranged for economical family vacations by buying, at public auction, a large bus. The bus, oddly enough, had once been used as a mobile TB clinic, and to accommodate an X-ray machine, a turret-like extrusion had been added to its roof. The bus's brand name was Bluebird. The Bluebird Inn, the farmers called it. Meanwhile, Paul Jr., P.J. or Pell to his family, was flourishing. His sisters remember him as a scrawny boy, intense in anger and affection. And, they'd say, he had this huge brain. The elementary school authorities placed him in a gifted and talented class. In fourth grade, he started a herpetology club. He invited all his classmates to the house for the first meeting and asked Jenny to make Rice Krispies treats. None of his classmates came, and he was very quiet for a time, a sure sign to his older sister that he was upset. But the family, in effect, became the club, attendance required by the warden's decree. They'd meet in the living room. PJ would dress up in a bathrobe and point with a stick at charcoal drawings he'd made of reptiles and amphibians. Even his siblings had to admit the pictures were beautiful. He'd discourse on the animals' diets, reproduction, lifespans, their interesting and unusual characteristics. He'd always announce each species by its Latin name. A sister remembered thinking, "We should just beat him up and go back out and play." But after a while, she and the others would get interested and start asking questions. Both his grandmothers were devout Roman Catholics, and his family went to church, and he went through the rites of First Communion and Confirmation, even serving as an altar boy for a time. But he didn't feel engaged. It was perfunctory, he'd remember. Although I liked the Mass itself, and still do, but it was nowhere near as exciting as the stuff I was reading. The parents of some fellow students in the gifted and talented class owned a bookstore, and when he was about 11 they gave him a copy of J.R.R. Tolkien's trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. He read it all in the space of a couple of days, and immediately read it again. Then he brought the book to the public library, and told the woman at the desk, "I want other books like this." She gave him a handful of fantasy novels. He brought them back. "No, this isn't it." That went on for a time, until finally one day the librarian, no doubt with some misgivings, the boy was only 11 years old, handed him a copy of War and Peace. "This is it," he told the librarian about a week later. "This is just like Lord of the Rings." Years afterward he'd say, "I mean, what could be more religious than Lord of the Rings or War and Peace?" Sales work in Alabama disappointed the warden. He turned to teaching, but the atmosphere in Birmingham in the latter 1960s made him and Jenny worry for their children's safety. The warden found a job in a public school in Florida, and so one day in 1971 the family stowed their belongings inside the Bluebird Inn, all that it would hold. The warden and Jenny and the children wrestled the washing machine out to the bus, but it wouldn't fit through the side doors. One of Farmer's most vivid memories was of the moment when they pulled away from their rented house in Birmingham. He watched his pretty young mother gaze sadly out the back windows of their bus at the washing machine, white among the bits of coal that littered the backyard. It would be her last washing machine for many years. They headed for Brooksville, a small town north of Tampa near the Gulf Coast. Farmer's older sister remembered riding in the Bluebird Inn down the town's fancy street, all overhung with Spanish moss and flanked by houses with antebellum-looking porticos, and the warden at the bus's wheel saying, "We'll get a house like one of these." For the time being, though, they drove out to the Brentwood Lake campground, a trailer park beside a piney woods. The warden must have been preoccupied. He drove toward the campground office and either forgot about the turret on the roof or didn't see the power wires overhead. In any case, the turret snagged the wires and tore them down. After the mess was sorted out, the warden found a concrete block for a front step, and they settled in. Jenny took a cashier's job at a Winn-Dixie supermarket and learned to work the register while smiling at customers and stomping on the pedal that moved the conveyor belt. She was a Winn-Dixie cashier who read Cry the Beloved Country to her children at night and, years later, went to Smith College and got her bachelor's degree. What none of the family remembered from those days in Florida was hearing her complain. "My mother is like the Virgin Mary without the virgin part," one of Farmer's sisters would say. "Loving, kind, non-judgmental. She was the calm one, always." Jenny would remark years later that she wished she had stood up to her husband and defied him more often. But this was the era of the dutiful wife, and besides, she said, "You didn't argue with Paul Farmer. You just didn't." She also said, "We knew that he loved us. In the turret, the warden had constructed a tier of 3 bunks for the boys. PJ's was on top. He'd lie on it and read and do his homework, while down below his brother Jeff practiced playing the drums, now and then declaring, "And this is the Krupa beat." PJ excelled in school regardless. He had some advantages, he'd say. The kind of father who thought it reasonable to house his family in a bus was also the kind who saw no reason PJ shouldn't keep a large aquarium inside. Farmer insisted that he never really felt deprived throughout his childhood, though he did allow, "It was pretty strange." He remembered coming back to the campground on a school bus once, and an African-American classmate saying to him, "Is this where you stay at?" They remained at the campground for 5 years, and took trips away in the bus. The warden hadn't fully figured out the vehicle's wiring. He never did. And every time they pulled into a campground and plugged into a power outlet, there was a 50-50 chance that whoever did the plugging in would insert the plug wrong, reversing the polarity, and get a nasty shock. The boys would argue, "I did it last time." The warden seems not to have thought about labeling the plug, maybe because he didn't take a turn at inserting it himself. He was too busy at other tasks, Jenny would tell me with a smile. One time, returning from a trip to Massachusetts, his jury-rigged device for towing a car behind the bus malfunctioned in a rainstorm on an interstate. The Bluebird Inn slithered off the highway, then plunged down a steep embankment, then flipped onto its roof. The turret kept the bus from rolling. Miraculously, no one got seriously injured, but it took the warden some months to repair, more or less, their living quarters. When Farmer told me this story, I asked him where he'd stayed in the meantime. "In a tent, of course. What kind of a question is that?" There were times inside the bus when the warden would dance around and sing, times when he'd read them Shakespeare plays and books, such as Aesop's Fables. But at least for Farmer's older sister Katie, even his reading aloud could be nerve-wracking. There was the Swiss Family Robinson. When he'd read a little way into that tale of a shipwrecked family which finds happiness by living rustically on an island, Katie thought to herself, "Uh-oh." Later, when he got a few pages into Robinson Crusoe, she thought, "No, please." There had been other ominous signs. The warden had never gone to sea, but even back in Alabama, he'd been buying boating magazines. He had a great stack of them by now. Around the time PJ entered high school, the warden bought at public auction an old Liberty launch, a 50-foot-long empty hull with a hole in it, which he repaired. Then he took a year off from his paying jobs. He was teaching school and working with retarded adults in Brooksville. He built a cabin for the boat, cussing and fuming, learning his ship's carpentry such as it was as he went along. In the middle of his labors, the whole family had to pitch in, he started running short of cash, and he announced to PJ and the 2 younger boys, "We're going to pick citrus." PJ said, "But Dad, white people don't pick citrus." "Yeah? I'll give you white people." Most of the workers up on ladders in the orange trees were black, in fact. PJ heard them talking from tree to tree in a strange language and asked his father what it was. "Creole. They're Haitians," the warden explained. To young Paul, he described briefly the epic poverty of their country. But PJ didn't get to know any Haitians then. The farmers didn't work in the groves long enough. The pay was meager. After a few days, the warden called it quits. He went back to work on the boat, which he named the Lady Jin, after his wife. When he declared it finished, he bought a generator for it and a fair amount of fishing gear that they really couldn't afford, but that, he insisted, would pay for itself in no time. According to his plan, the boat would make them truly independent. It would serve as both their home and a source of revenue through commercial fishing. Their first voyage began on a calm and sunny day, the warden at the helm. They steamed out into the Gulf of Mexico, far out of sight of land. They anchored in the shallow waters of the Gulf, had lunch, and swam, PJ and his siblings cavorting all around the boat. But they hauled up only a few edible fish, and then, that night, a storm blew in. The wind was howling, the boat was pitching at its anchor, and Jenny became terrified. Fear must have made her as implacable as her husband, because at some point that night, at her insistence, he tied a rope to the generator and threw it overboard as a second anchor. Meanwhile, down in their berths, in the rocking, rolling cabin, the children were enjoying themselves immensely. Cool! A storm! Years later, Farmer's brother Jeff would tell me that he'd known all along his father was incompetent in boats. Even as they'd motored out that morning, he'd realized that the man knew nothing about navigation. But the thing was, it was a strange feeling. You knew he didn't know what he was doing, but you also felt the security, that he would get us out of the situation, that nothing was really going to beat him. Ginny, for all the frights he put her through, would say of the warden, "He was a great risk-taker, and everything always turned out all right." She paused. "I mean, no one ever got seriously hurt." The next day, heading landward, the warden got lost and grazed a rock, but they made it safely into port. The Lady Jin went on a few other short, eventful voyages. On one of those, the warden disregarded the channel markers. He seemed to think they represented arbitrary rules that he was not obliged to follow. And Jeff said, "Dad, you're not in the channel." The warden said, "Shut up, what do you know about it?" And a moment later, ran them hard aground. But for the most part, after its first and only fishing trip, the Lady Jin stayed moored in an otherwise uninhabited bayou on the Gulf Coast named Jenkins Creek. On a bookcase shelf in his little house in the parched hills of inland Haiti, Farmer kept a photograph of that other home. The Lady Jin, painted white but not very recently, floats, moored to a metal pipe in the inlet. It's surrounded by marsh grasses, tall palm trees in the background. A gangplank leads to terra firma. A TV antenna sits on top of the cabin, and the cabin, a square superstructure planted on a rounded hull, doesn't quite fit. The Bluebird Inn doesn't appear in the photograph, but it was parked nearby, ready for family excursions, on a dirt road beside the creek. The warden was happy there. He had his family where he seems to have wanted them, on an island, so to speak, safe from malign influences. As for young Paul, he loved the bayou, the starlit solitude, the osprey that lived in a nest off the Lady Jin's starboard bow, the otters that would swim by, the alligators they'd hear barking at night. He'd save the money from his part-time jobs in Brooksville, at Hogan's Drugstore and at Biff Burger, to buy materials for landscaping and for a fish pond across from their gangplank. And he does not seem to have been very discouraged by the high tides that periodically wiped out his handiwork. The bayou life was hardest on Ginny. She worked all day at the Winn-Dixie and had to take care of 6 children and a husband on a boat. PJ's 2 brothers were growing up to be as large as their father. Their appetites were huge, and the refrigerator in the cabin was so small she had to restock it daily. When it rained, they put pots and pans beneath the leaks in the cabin's roof. At night, cockroaches skittered in the bilge like a room full of impatient women tapping their fingernails on tables. They washed their clothes in a laundromat in town, and themselves and their dishes in the brackish water of the bayou. They got their drinking water some miles away, usually from a spigot outside a convenience store, surreptitiously filling the jugs that rattled around in the back of one or another of the vehicles that the warden bought at auction. The truck of many colors, or the olive-drab army surplus sedan that they called the staff car, purchased by sealed bid for $288. Once, on a lonesome road from Brooksville, the staff car overheated. They had no water with them, so the warden ordered the boys to urinate into the radiator. The cars embarrassed PJ and his siblings, especially the staff car. On the way to school one morning, they asked the warden to drop them off a block away. Instead, he drove right into the bus lane in front of the whole school, honking the horn as he pulled up. "That'll show you," he said. Farmer would say of his childhood, "The way I tell myself the story is a little too neat. I'd like to be able to say that when I was young I lived in a trailer park, picked fruit with Haitians, got interested in migrant farm workers, and went to Latin America. All true, but not the truth. We're asked to have tidy biographies that are coherent. Everyone does that, but the fact is, a perfectly discrepant version has the same ending. Indeed, growing up without running water on a bus and a boat, with the warden at the helm, hardly implies a single personality or fate. All Farmer's siblings grew up to live in houses. One of his sisters became a commercial artist, another the manager of community relations for a hospital's mental health programs, the third a motivational speaker. One brother was an electrician, and Jeff became a professional wrestler, known to his fans as Super J, and to his family as the Gentle Giant. No question, though, that Farmer's childhood was good preparation for a traveling life. Like all his siblings, he emerged from the bayou's waters with what he called a very compliant GI system, and from dinners of hot dog bean soup without much fussiness about food, and from years of cramped quarters with the ability to concentrate anywhere. He could sleep in a dentist's chair, as he did at night for most of one summer in a clinic in Haiti, and consider it an improvement over other places he had slept. And one might suppose that his fondness for a fine hotel and a good bottle of wine had the same origins. After the staff car, Farmer would say, it was hard to feel embarrassed or shy in front of anyone. He allowed that growing up as he did also probably relieved him of a homing instinct. I never had a sense of a hometown. It was, this is my campground. Then I got to the bottom of the barrel and it was, oh, this is my hometown. He meant Cange. It was partly to avoid the onerous houseboat chores assigned them by their father that Farmer and his siblings threw themselves into virtually every extracurricular activity that Hernando High in Brooksville offered. No couch potatoes in the family, I said once to Farmer's mother. No couch, she replied. Farmer was very popular in school, especially among the girls. The reason was simple, his mother said. He listened to them. He graduated valedictorian of his class and went to Duke on a full scholarship. To Farmer's great surprise, as Ginny remembered, he didn't get straight A's his first semester at college. Everything was new. He was soaking up high culture. He became drama critic and art critic for a student newspaper. The first play he'd ever seen was one he was sent to review. He was also discovering wealth. He met a fellow freshman in his dorm named Todd McCormick, the son of a very successful sports agent. How come you put your shirts in plastic? Farmer asked, watching McCormick unpack. He was a brainy kid from a small South Florida town to whom hot showers were something of a novelty, who didn't have the right clothes or much spending money, and at Duke he had a couple of classmates whose father bought them a condominium so they wouldn't have to live in a dorm. For a time, he dated a girl who kept her own horse near campus. Like about 60% of the student body, he joined a fraternity, and he became its social director. I was pretty taken by it. By wealth, he remembered. Nearly taken in. There was a period during his first 2 years at Duke when to some of the family it seemed that PJ might be making that customary American rite of passage and turning his back on them. He came home from college wearing a Lacoste shirt, and he said something to the effect that he couldn't wear clothes that weren't preppy. Yeah, well, said the warden, Pell the preppy can still clean the bilge. One time one of his younger sisters visited him at Duke, and over breakfast with PJ and his current well-heeled girlfriend, his sister told in great graphic detail the story of how, in the bayou, she'd killed and disemboweled a pregnant water moccasin and made what she called a Medusa hat for Paul out of the remains. The story had the effect she'd hoped for, the girlfriend pushing away her uneaten omelet while PJ turned bright red trying to keep from laughing. Farmer remembered coming home from college once and the warden opening the tailgate of his derelict pickup truck to reveal a chaos of worthless old lumber, a couple of wasps flying out, and the warden saying, with his sardonic smile, "Someday, son, this will all be yours." By then, Farmer had quit his fraternity. He wrote them that he couldn't belong to an all-white organization. "I received quite a frosty reply," he would say, in a tone of voice that implied this still surprised him. He'd come to admire his father's distaste for putting on airs and the man's fondness for underdogs, for the retarded adults he worked with, and the neighbors at the trailer park, who one year gave all the farmer children piggy banks made out of old Clorox bottles, and his tendency to give money away to people who were truly poor. Farmer returned home less and less during his last years at Duke, but it wasn't as though he still intended, if he ever had, to trade in his old life for something fancier. He had to get out from under his father, Ginny explained. Back home, everything would revert to the old order. All the farmer children, according to their mother, had craved their father's approval. He made it hard to get. Come home from high school with an A on a paper and he'd say, "Did anyone get an A plus?" The warden loved sports. Farmer's brothers excelled at all. PJ wasn't good at any, but he tried. It was an item of family lore that during the year he played baseball, the only thing he hit with a bat was the head of the coach's son, by accident. In high school, He went out for tennis and track and would push himself so hard in races that he'd throw up at the finish lines. "When I think of it, I could just cry," Ginny would say. He wanted to show his father he was an athlete too, and his father would be so proud of him now. Actually, according to his brother Jeff, the warden bragged about PJ constantly, his test scores, his full scholarship to Duke, but only when PJ wasn't around. He was unbelievably proud of PJ, but he wouldn't tell him, because he was the kind of guy who thought, "I don't want your head to get too big." In the warden's evolving dream, his children grew up and had families and all settled down around him and Ginny in one large compound. Instead, one by one, they began leaving home. Then the man who owned the land beside Jenkins Creek died. The county purchased the property, and the farmers had to leave. They moved ashore to a trailer home on 2 acres in a pine barren off Star Road in Brooksville. Only the two youngest daughters, Jennifer and Peggy, were still around by then. They called their new home Star Road State Prison. The Lady Gin had to be removed from its long anchorage. The warden decided he would take it to a harbor farther south. He brought along only Jennifer, a teenager then. His navigation hadn't improved. His disdain for buoys and channel markers still endured. "He got the boat beached on a sandbar all night and couldn't get it off," Jennifer remembered. In the morning, he told her, "We're just going to burn it right here." He said he wanted to give their boat a Viking funeral out at sea. "No one else is going to live on it," he said. So he and Jennifer went through the boat and collected all the things they thought worth keeping, books and pictures mostly, and they loaded them into the dinghy, the Mini Ginny, which they rowed to a marina. They were in the process of buying gasoline for the Viking funeral when a man on the docks got wind of the warden's mad intentions. "Don't do that. You'll kill yourselves. Besides, I want the engine." The man towed the Lady Gin off the sandbar and brought it into port. The warden did burn the family boat, though, in a bonfire on land. Looking back, Jennifer would say that her brother Paul and her father shared certain qualities. Above all, she thought, once they'd focused on a goal, neither one would quit. Her father had thought he could conquer the very elements. Nothing and no one ever seemed to intimidate him. "The only time I saw him vulnerable, ever, was that morning when he decided to burn the boat. Nothing was working right. The boat was aground, his kids were leaving, and he had no good helpers anymore." He died a few years later, in July 1984, while playing a pickup game of basketball. He was 49, and to all outward appearances, had been a healthy man. He'd probably had a heart attack. The telephone had not brought out the man's best qualities. When PJ had learned he'd been accepted at Harvard Medical School, he'd called home from Haiti to tell his parents, and the warden had said, "Oh yeah, we knew you'd get in." It had been, at moments anyway, a difficult relationship. Farmer had a steady girlfriend by the time the warden died. Not long after the funeral, she went to Florida with PJ. They stayed at Star Road State Prison. The Bluebird Inn was parked there, semi-derelict, and he went inside the bus and found some old books and letters. His girlfriend left on a brief errand. She remembered, "I came back and PJ was sitting in the driver's seat, holding a letter his father wrote to him when he got into medical school. It said something like, 'I just want you to know how proud I am.'" And PJ was sobbing. Chapter 6. Old college friends describe a boy who made friends easily, legions of them, at least as many female as male, and who had a photographic memory for facts about each one. He'd ask about relatives that I didn't remember I'd even mentioned to him. If you went to lunch with him at a campus hangout, it could take half an hour to get to a table. He had to stop so often to chat with other people. He liked company when studying, and if you stayed up late with him to do it, you'd feel as though the work came more easily to him than to you. But then he'd start a food fight or make weird close-up images of his face on the copying machine, and later you'd all walk back across the silent campus loudly singing songs from The Sound of Music, Raindrops on Roses and Whiskers on Kittens. After his first semester, Farmer started getting A's. He spent one summer and fall in Paris. He went there with only a little money and no job, and found a Franco-American family that wanted an au pair. His mother would send a $5 bill in her weekly letter, and he'd use it to go to plays. On his days off, he went to political demonstrations. "It's Saturday," the man of the house would say to him. "What demonstration did you go to today?" He took 4 courses in Paris, among them the last ever taught by the anthropologist Claude Levi Strauss, so infirm by then he had to be carried up onto the stage. By the time Farmer returned to Duke, he read, wrote, and spoke French fluently. He studied mostly science in his first 2 years of college, then focused on medical anthropology. He also read widely in subjects not assigned. Many professors were fond of him, and he of them. He wrote his senior honors thesis on gender inequality and depression, no doubt in part because the medical anthropologists he knew were all psychiatrists. But he didn't claim any as a mentor. That distinction went to a German polymath named Rudolf Virchow, dead for the better part of a century. Compared with other historical figures in medicine, such as Pasteur or Schweitzer or Florence Nightingale, Virchow isn't very well known. Only 1 full-length biography of him exists, yet he was, as one commentator writes, the principal architect of the foundations of scientific medicine, the first to propose that the basic units of biological life were self-reproducing cells, and that the study of disease should focus on changes in the cell. Virchow made important contributions in oncology and parasitology, coined at least 50 medical terms still in use today, defined the pathophysiology of a host of diseases, including trichinosis, and led a successful campaign for compulsory meat inspection in Germany. He designed a sewage system for Berlin that transformed it from a fetid sty into one of Europe's healthiest cities. He founded a nursing school and hospitals. He was a practicing archaeologist and played an instrumental role in Heinrich Schliemann's excavations of Troy. He helped to define the field of medical anthropology. He was a physician and a teacher and a practicing politician, so nettlesome in opposition to Germany's imperial ambitions that Bismarck once challenged him to a duel. Virchow published more than 2,000 papers and dozens of books. At Duke, Farmer read some of his work in translation and several articles about him. Virchow's was a career to stir a brainy youth's imagination, an adventure that combined deeds and intellect, launched at an early age. When he was only 26, the German government sent Virchow to Upper Silesia to report on an epidemic of what was then termed famine fever, now called relapsing fever. Virchow found a region impoverished by absentee landlordism, where the people, mainly Polish, lived principally on potatoes and vodka and suffered from endemic malaria and dysentery. In his report to the German government, he wrote that abysmal social conditions, which the government had fostered and done nothing to relieve, had caused the epidemic. This was 40 years before medical science identified all the biological sources of relapsing fever. Its vector is the louse. But subsequent discoveries would show that Virchow was right. Epidemics of the illness usually occur after social upheavals, in the ensuing overcrowding, poor hygiene, and malnutrition. In his report, Virchow expressed a fundamental law of epidemiology. If disease is an expression of individual life under unfavorable conditions, then epidemics must be indicative of mass disturbances of mass life. His prescription for curing Upper Silesia was full and unlimited democracy. This meant, among other things, establishing Polish as the official language, taxing the rich instead of the poor, getting the church out of the business of government, building roads, reopening orphanages, investing in agriculture. The government fired him. Virchow would write, "My politics were those of prophylaxis. My opponents preferred those of palliation." He had a knack for aphorism. "Medicine is a social science, and politics is nothing but medicine on a large scale. It is the curse of humanity that it learns to tolerate even the most horrible situations by habituation. Medical education does not exist to provide students with a way of making a living, but to ensure the health of the community. The physicians are the natural attorneys of the poor, and the social problems should largely be solved by them." This last was Farmer's favorite. Virchow put the world together in a way that made sense to Farmer. Virchow had a comprehensive vision. he said. Pathology, social medicine, politics, anthropology. My model. Farmer had acquired, partly through Virchow, a moral understanding of public health. While at Duke, he also found a subject. He was reading very widely in anthropology and history and sociology and political science. He was interested in current events, especially in the violent troubles in Latin America. In 1980, when Archbishop Oscar Romero was murdered by a right-wing death squad in El Salvador, faculty and students held a protest vigil at the Duke Chapel, and Farmer attended. He also did some reading about the branch of Catholicism called liberation theology, which Romero had been murdered for preaching. Latin American theologians had developed the doctrine, and in the late 1960s, Latin America's Catholic bishops had endorsed some of its tenets. The bishop, who had confirmed PJ back in Brooksville, had delivered a homily mainly about the perils of premarital sex. In the church documents Farmer read now, the Latin American bishops spoke about the oppression of the poor, calling it institutionalized sin. They declared that the church had a duty to provide a preferential option for the poor. Farmer remembered thinking, "Wow, this ain't the Catholicism I remember." But he wasn't mainly impelled by politics or religion, he'd say. He felt more curious about the world than outraged. He had the sense that the truth about events in places like El Salvador lay hidden from most Americans. And it was in the same spirit, mainly, that he got interested in the migrant labor camps not far from Duke. Here I am in the middle of a very affluent university, with a lot of comfortable ideas, and I met this nun. She was Belgian, Juliana de Wolf, working with the Friends of the United Farm Workers, and she was a fearless article. I just remember thinking she was much more radical and committed than anyone I'd met, arrogant and humble at the same time. The Haitian farm workers thought the world of her. He met others like her, church ladies, he called them, and he was impressed not by their piety, but by what they were willing to do on behalf of the migrant workers. They were just so much more militant, if that's the word, than the WLs and academics. They were the ones standing up to the growers in their sensible nun shoes. They were the ones schlepping the workers to the clinics or court, translating for them, getting them groceries or driver's licenses. In Sister Juliana's company, on tours of North Carolina tobacco plantations, he met a number of Haitians. The wretched conditions they lived in made the circumstances of his own childhood seem idyllic. He began reading everything he could find about Haiti. By the time he graduated, he knew enough to write an article of 6,000 words about the Haitian farm workers laboring in the fields near Duke. He called it Haitians Without a Home. At home and abroad, he'd come to think, Haitians were the underdogs of underdogs, the shafted of the shafted. Farmer left Duke. He graduated summa cum laude, interested in all things Haitian. He visited Chrome Detention Center in Florida and joined protests against what seemed to him the rank injustice of an American immigration policy that let in virtually every refugee from Cuba and sent nearly every fleeing Haitian back to hunger and disease, and what had to be the Caribbean's cruelest, most self-serving dictatorship. By now, he had certainly progressed, as he would put it, from curiosity to indignation. But curiosity remained. The history of the country seemed worthy of a Homer or a Tolstoy, or especially to Farmer, a Tolkien. The landing of Columbus on the island that he named Hispaniola, and the extermination of the Arawak Indians that followed, the division of the island between France and Spain, which left the French in possession of the island's western third, where they created an immensely lucrative and gruesome slave colony. A third of every new shipment of West African slaves died within 3 years. The slaves' long and bloody revolt, which began in 1791, and which not even Napoleon and 40,000 troops could put down. And at last, in 1804, the creation of Haiti, Latin America's first independent nation and the world's first black republic. But independence had been followed by nearly 200 years of misrule, aided and abetted by foreign powers, especially France and the United States. From 1915 to 1934, the U.S. Marines had occupied and run the country. To Farmer, Haiti's history seemed, indeed, like the Lord of the Rings, an ongoing story of a great and terrible struggle between the rich and the poor, between good and evil. What he read about the country's culture fascinated him. Haiti had its own music and literature. Paintings by Haitian artists hung in European and American museums. The people of Haiti had created their own complex religion, voodoo, with a rather distant supreme deity and a host of other gods, a pantheon including Catholic saints. It was a system of belief that seemed all the more worth studying because it was so widely misunderstood and ridiculed. And the Haitian tongue, Creole, was not, as was sometimes said, a coarse patois, but in essence a Romance language, derived from French and, in some of its phonetic habits and grammatical structures, also clearly African. It was unique to Haiti, lovely and expressive, and born of grim necessity. The French masters had deliberately separated slaves who spoke the same languages, and the slaves had fashioned their own tongue. Farmer began to study Creole before he went to Haiti in the spring of 1983. He planned to spend about a year there. He'd won a prize of $1,000 at Duke for an essay about Haitian artists, and he figured this should last him, since he'd read that the average Haitian lived on far less. He had worked as a volunteer in the emergency room at Duke's University Hospital and had begun applying to the two schools, Harvard and Case Western Reserve, where one could get a joint degree as a doctor anthropologist. He figured he'd find out if that was what he really wanted to become by trying out both disciplines in Haiti. In 1983, when Farmer landed in Port-au-Prince, the airport was still named François Duvalier in honor of the infamous Papa Doc, who had ruled the country with liberal use of terror from 1957 until his death in 1971. His reign was being continued now in the person of his son, Baby Doc, a little less crafty than his father, but with the same proclivity for murdering political enemies and for stealing and misappropriating foreign aid. He would soon proclaim himself president for life. In fact, the Duvaliers' 3 decades in power were nearly up, but no one knew that then. The Haiti that Farmer first encountered ranked as an exotic destination for tourists, including sex tourists. Haitians are a comely people, the majority desperately poor. One international guide for gay tourists reported in 1983, "Your partners will expect to be paid for their services, but the charges are nominal." Port-au-Prince was a city full of slums, but it also had a few fancy neighborhoods and some good restaurants and hotels, and it was very safe for a tourist, patrolled by, among others, the Duvalier's Praetorian Guard, the men in dark glasses, the Tonton Macoute, named for a mythical bogeyman, Uncle Sack, who stuffed bad children into his bag. They didn't harass tourists, not unless they looked in a suitcase and found a copy of Graham Greene's mordant anti-Duvalierist novel of Haiti, The Comedians. Even then, they'd merely administer a harangue. Farmer didn't bring his copy of the novel, and he didn't hang around in the city at first. During a brief postgraduate fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh, he had met a member of the Mellon family. They had used part of their fortune to build a hospital in Haiti, the Hôpital Albert Schweitzer, situated in the town of Deschapelles in the lower Artibonite Valley. Farmer journeyed out there from Port-au-Prince almost as soon as he arrived. He had high expectations, and it was a good-looking hospital, he thought. But it was staffed mainly by white expatriate doctors. He'd imagined something different, a hospital at least partly devoted to training Haitians to treat Haitians. Besides, the Schweitzer didn't have a job for him just then, in spite of his Mellon contact. He went back to the city feeling, he'd say, deflated. He began looking around for other situations. He came across a small charity called I Care Haiti, with headquarters in Port-au-Prince. It conducted mobile outreach clinics in the countryside and kept a small house as a base for those operations out in the central plateau, in the town of Mirebalais. Farmer headed there. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.